The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, and 24/7 support. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
Football Weekly Extra. Today, football. Hitzlsperger the hero. Meanwhile, Man United and West Ham also coming out this week of the League Cup, that is. We ask, what next for Man United and the Hammers? And then it's on to the weekend. Man City just a point behind Arsenal. The Citizens a good watch, but have no interest in keeping seconds. Can they win at Newcastle? What awaits Arsenal against notorious bogey side Aston Villa? We hear from Spain. Messi's return and Di Maria handling in the box. Plus, Football League, FIFA trolling the entire planet, and more in this Football Weekly Extra. Hey, everybody. It's a happy new year to John Ashdown.
Hello there.
Ian McIntosh.
Hello.
And his brother, Paul.
Hello there.
Hi, Paul Mac.
Intosh.
Exactly.
Paul McIntosh. That's not the first time I've heard that, yeah.
Paul McInnes.
Hi.
Hi there. How are you, Ian?
I'm all right, thank you.
Good. Paul, you all right?
Yes, very well, thanks.
Great. John?
I'm fine, yeah.
What did you do for New Year's Eve? That's the question. Listeners are demanding to know the answer.
For the first time in a long time, we've had a nice, quiet night in.
Really? Yeah. What do you normally do on New Year's
Usually, Eve? Usually, I'm, you know, partying down with the kids and all that sort of stuff.
Right. And this time you around. Just, what, sandwich telly or what?
I had a bit of Jules Holland, a bit of Hootenanny.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
All right, good. Oh, I'll ask the rest of you now, since we're here.
I got smashed on my friend's patio. It was lovely.
Really?
Yeah. It was really, you know, it's a tradition where I come from to drink too much at that time of the year and then fall over. And it's something that I do take very, very seriously, culturally.
Excellent. Paul?
I spent it alone in my sitting room reading a book.
Really? Which book are you reading?
I'm reading a book about the art of telling story. It's really interesting, actually.
Yeah.
It's by a book called John York. It's called Into the Woods. How all story conforms to a particular type. It's very interesting.
Well, there's that... Kurt Vonnegut talks about the parabola of Western storytelling. Is it a similar thing?
It kind of takes these different bits and it looks at it through the prism of movies.
What's the key fact that you've learnt about telling stories?
Every film has a midpoint, and the midpoint is the most exciting bit of the film. So everything that you remember from watching a film, or the most memorable part of a film, is the midpoint. It'll have happened exactly in the middle.
I'm going to say no to that. I'm going to say Sixth Sense wasn't the middle part that I remember. Crying Game wasn't the middle part that I remember.
Okay, so maybe I've slightly defined the criteria a little bit wrong, but the key...
Right. Here's producer Ben with, no, Luke, I am your father.
And that's at the end.
Kind of.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
in the middle of the trilogy, so it kind of forms the middle of the overarching story.
And really, the middle part of Star Wars is where Luke throws off the shackles of his uncle and aunt and leaves Tatooine.
Technically, that's not actually the middle, because it's, six of the way through.
So. Yeah, that's true.
But that's kind of heresy to beat that way. Oh, crikey, look, it's the League Cup, and we haven't talked about it at all.
But hang on, aren't they doing three more Star Wars, so it is going to be...
It is going to be the middle bit. Crikey. Yeah. If only Man City West Ham had been this closely combated. Hey, John.
Yeah, it was the evil empire against the... It wasn't really, was it? I don't know how that analogy doesn't fit at all, because City just absolutely
demolished
them.
Funny, because Ian, you actually specifically cited the empire your reference to how badly... In terms of bullying, you said, I think it was around about 5-0. We're now at the level of blowing up Princess Leia's home planet Alderaan, just to show you can.
Yeah, just to prove weapon specs.
Right.
You know.
Anyway, enough Star Wars stuff. Let's talk about that football. As everybody and their mother has said, good thing Big Sam rested those players. Hey!
It was shocking. I think that the most shocking thing about it was they had their pants pulled down in front of everyone, which, you know, can happen. But you expect there to be some kind of fight. There wasn't even a single booking. They barely put in a tackle. No. I'm not saying there'd be a better team if they did get booked, but it might at least show that they were bothered.
Well, Leroy was senior on the football the League Cup show afterwards, making that very point. I think the entire game played in West Ham's half, there was something like, what, 7 fouls or something, and not a single booking?
You've got to fight for it at the very least, even if you're not good enough to keep up. It was as cowardly a performance as I've seen in ages. Though we should be careful, because the last person we called a coward was Marouane Chamakh, who then went on a scoring spree.
That's
so
true.
Well, beware our
powers. Unlikely in this case, perhaps. What about, speaking of scoring sprees, Negredo, who equally you described as going through West Ham's defence like a brick through a stained glass window.
He's magnificent, isn't he? He's so fast and so powerful. I know he wasn't up against the strongest defence yesterday, it must be said. Roger Johnson was pretty much backpedalling away from anything that looked threatening. And I'm not sure poor old McCartney was entirely sure of where he was supposed to be standing at which point. But there just didn't seem to be anything that they could do to stop Negredo, short of digging large trenches and setting up spear traps.
Right.
Which I don't think is strictly legal at the moment.
Not yet, no.
And the same pretty much applied to Edin Dzeko's goals as well. Yeah. I mean, his finishes were excellent too.
And Yaya Touré's gallop as well.
Oh, that was a terrible goal. Absolutely. I mean, the Roger Johnson just showing him inside, like showing it inside. Here's the straight, direct route to goal. Don't worry, I'm not going to challenge you. Yeah, exactly. But if you're worried about finding out precisely where you need to find the onion bag, here's me to show you.
If you didn't like that goal, which goal did you like? Was it perhaps that glorious hoof from Yaya Touré to Negredo? And
that was beautiful, although to a certain extent it reminds you of Germany against England or something. I don't know that ball should have really got to him, or at least he shouldn't have been able to take that first time, put it in the goal. I think Edin Dzeko's second was a wonderful finish.
Right. John, what did you think?
The finish for Negredo's first was lovely. But as Paul says, the gap between them was ludicrous. And the whole signing of Roger Johnson sort of, I don't know if that speaks about the sort of mess that West Ham are in because they're that desperate, or if it's just a massive lack of kind of judgment from Allardyce. Because anybody who's watched Roger Johnson for the last sort of 3 or 4 years, I mean, people were talking about him as a future England centre-half a while back, I mean, a fair while back. But for the last 3 or 4 seasons, he's been dreadful and incredibly divisive at Wolves. I don't think he's a Premier League defender anymore.
He may not have to be, of course,
For very long, anyway.
Yeah. Well, Manchester City now one goal, reveals Pete Jensen, short of last season's total, and this with 5 months of the campaign to go. They are absolutely on fire. We'll talk about their prospects at Newcastle in the league a little bit later on. But West Ham, then, huge game this weekend for them as well, isn't it, West Ham? They are up against Cardiff, who are 2 places above them in 17th. And, of course, this is the first league game for Ole Gunnar Solskjaer after his terrific debut in the FA Cup.
Against away at Newcastle.
Away at Newcastle.
Yeah, which is an interesting precedent, I guess, for Man City, maybe. But, I think Solskjaer's just completed his first signing, a playmaker from Heerenveen, which I think is it's perhaps the one area in the side that they're lacking that creativity. So maybe that's an indication of things, a good prospect.
They do look as though they got a bit of a boost. I mean, judging by that FA Cup game, at least, Cardiff.
Yeah, they've got rid of that uncertainty now. For the past few months, they've been playing under the cloud. They knew that Mackay's exit was inevitable, but now there's a chance to kind of sweep it clear and start again. And football fans are nothing if not expedient. You know, if they get some results in now, if they start to pull away from the relegation zone, I think they'll you know, probably be an awful lot happier about things on a wider scale. And so much is about momentum, and Cardiff have now got this ticket out of the murkier areas, whereas West Ham just keep getting murkier.
Right. Big Sam prospects, John?
It's a dangerous one for him because they're up against a team who have just replaced their manager. You know, if Cardiff put on a bit of a show and displayed just what a new guy can do, you know, Sullivan and Gold might take interest.
Right. Just say West Ham have lost their last 5 games on the road. So it doesn't bode brilliantly.
And they've done really badly against the teams around them in the relegation scrap as well.
They've done really badly against everyone, really, apart from Tottenham.
Apart from Spurs. Well, more on the weekend later on. But Wednesday's enormous goals haul for Man City against West Ham rather took the spotlight off Man United's 3rd defeat in a week, which came Tuesday away at Sunderland. David Moyes absolutely irate after this one because of the awarding of the free kick, which led to a Sunderland goal, and also the penalty, which led to a Sunderland goal. Ian?
I have to have some sympathy with Moyes in that it probably wasn't a penalty, though quite what Cleverley thought he was doing by jabbing his foot down like that. He was about 6 foot away from the ball at the time.
It was a suicidal move.
It's usually the point where people go, oh, it's clumsy if nothing else. It wasn't just clumsy, it was brain-breakingly stupid. But I still don't think there was really any contact. However, you've got to have a little more dignity than to go out saying we're playing against the referees, we're not getting these decisions, we're not getting these calls. You're at Sunderland, for the love of all that's holy. Right. It's Manchester United, who won the title by 11 points, away at Sunderland, a team who've been kind of anchored to the relegation zone all season long. You've got to have more about you than just blaming referees.
Well, that quote, "We're playing the refs now too," not match the day tweeting, "League game since Man United last conceded a penalty, 78. Of course, this was in the League Cup, but still.
I mean, it wouldn't be the first time that a Manchester United coach has made claims, grandiose claims, that aren't backed up by the evidence. And in a way, having Moyes come out and say these sorts of things is perhaps the most convincing part of the job he's doing. He does seem to be fronting up to the press quite well. But the negativity, the non-aggressive approach to matches, the desire to not lose first, I think is something that's really getting to certainly the United fans that I speak to. And in a way, they can forgive him the paucity of the squad, but they can't forgive him for not trying to win.
Is that fair? Is that what happened? They just didn't try to win? Or
No, I'm sure they probably tried to win. It's just that they don't seem capable of doing it. They're very, very one-dimensional, particularly in their ambitions for what to do with the ball. Everything's out to the flanks. Everything's looking for crosses to come in.
Right, it's almost as if they were reliant on two big players, neither of whom are available at the moment, and we're not quite sure when they'll be back.
No, they're certainly going to struggle without them, as any team would struggle without their best players. But there's also been some strange revisionism about this. There's been a lot of comments about, oh, he's turned them into Everton, but Everton weren't this bad. Everton were actually at times a very exciting side. They played some very, very inventive football. They had this dogs of war reputation, but it wasn't always completely deserved. But this is very one-dimensional, very plodding, very uninventive stuff, and it's obviously not good enough. I think given time and some serious investment in January, he can turn this around. But it's an
200
awful
million
start.
Some say 50 million say others, 100 million
but anything will do. Just one midfielder.
Right. Well, Claudio Marchisio among the names being touted this Thursday, but you know, different days bring different names in the rumour mill, so we'll see if that one has any legs. Well, three defeats in a week, as we say. Could it be four in 10 days? Because they are facing Swansea at home. Yikes! They've only just faced them at home in the FA Cup and lost, Paul.
Yeah, and you do. I think Ian's right. It's the lack of creativity, the lack of flair, the lack of ideas in the final third that seems to be persistent. And so, you know, there's obviously a case for them going out and looking to avenge that FA Cup defeat. But if they don't have the plan and they don't have the personnel, maybe there'll be a similar result. Swansea have actually been playing above expectations of late. Without picking up the results, they're still well placed in the table.
Right.
And given the number of games they've played over the course of the season, the personnel they've been missing through injury, Michu in particular.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, they did look good, certainly, when they visited the other day for the FA Cup. Boney with the goal. And some listeners were saying, why wasn't there more love for Wayne Routledge? Let's give him some, because he looked terrific, didn't he?
He did look terrific, and it was a beautiful, composed little finish. He's one of these players, when he doesn't have any time to think about things, that he's an instinctive player, and he does better. But I think Laudrup's done well with these players. A lot of players who you thought might have thought, 18 months into Laudrup's reign, might have been moved on or eased out of the squad, who are still coming in and giving performances. And yes, the results might not have been as good as they hope, but perhaps around where you might expect given the number of games. And I think there's rumours that they're closing in on Tom Ince as another a wingman.
Michael Laudrup versus David Moyes this weekend. Is it going to be four defeats on the spin? Can they do it again at Old Trafford?
Yeah, they could, absolutely, yeah.
What do you think?
Will they?
Yeah.
A draw would be my bet. But in a way, it doesn't really matter how United play, I don't think. They just need to get a couple of results under their belts.
Well, they did have a couple of results before.
Well, yeah, if you look at the form table, I think they're sort of fourth over the last six games or something like that.
In the league. Yeah.
The kind of stats, I mean, I don't know when the last time they lost four on the bounce was.
I think it was 1920s or something.
1960s,
like that.
I think.
Yeah, was it 60s, really? But in the league, it's true, they had four wins on the spin before the Spurs game. The notion being that it's when they come up against tough opposition, they found out, are Swansea at that level of being the tough opposition that find them out?
Swansea definitely can beat them. I don't think they will, though. I think there's going to be a reaction now. There's got to be a reaction now. If there isn't, then the whole project's doomed. They've got to come out now and give some semblance of a professional performance.
Yeah, it's been a couple of periods, haven't there, when they've had a period of disastrous results and they've managed to steady the ship and come back. I think it might be another one of those.
Right, well, we thought that before they went to Sunderland, of course.
Yeah, but I mean, it's a two-legged semi-final. They've got the home leg second. It wasn't be all or end all.
And it will be interesting to see the reaction from the players, in that there's been a few hints in the papers today of a bit of grumbling about his appointment and the way that he's...
David Moyes?
Yeah, yeah, and the way that he has replaced all the backroom staff and the way that he's basically running the club.
It does appear to be grumbling from people who aren't necessarily in the first 11, people like Rio, or, you know, Danny Welbeck is in currently, but has been in and out, and Vidic. So I want, you know, it depends on whether the core of his side, the Johnny Evans and people are with him or not, I think, more.
But when that kind of story surfaces about a manager who's having a crisis of results, is it not a very, very bad sign for his prospects?
Yes, it's certainly not a good sign. Mm. But as Paul said, they're kind of sort of slightly peripheral characters, but they are sort of senior names.
They are massive names, but it's also the sort of, it is quite commonplace, isn't it? I mean, there's quite a lot of... It's common in the Premier League nowadays, with the amount of media coverage that there is, that these sorts of stories, uncredited, do tend to come out. Most people get them at some point.
Mm. Quite rare to hear it from Man United, though.
Well, yeah, but that's Ferguson.
It's also because they were winning all the time. Yeah. All right, well, that's enough on that part. Hey, a little bit of music, and then off we go with the title race. Part two. Interesting at the top of the table. You've got three teams separated by 2 points, and it looks a little bit... Ian, you've got your big black folder of facts. So you've got Arsenal, Man City and Chelsea. Those three separated by 2 points, and you'd pick probably the title winner from those three, and then the next three, which are Liverpool, Everton and Spurs, they're kind of then battling for the final Champions League spot. Is that,
yeah,
is that
I think
a fair
that's
interpretation?
That's a fair assessment. I mean, Arsenal's negative is that they haven't won the big games against,
and yet they're still
against
top.
Their rivals, but they're beating everybody else. They're actually mentally strong now. They're having games like West Ham, when they went behind and could have gone two goals behind, which seems incredible after what we saw last night, but they came back to win 3-1. That tough game at St James's Park, that they came out with another 3 points. They are picking up the results, and I think there was a season when Manchester United did this a couple of years ago, where their record against the rest of the big four was absolutely abject, but they basically beat everybody else. And that's how you win a title. But the big concern, obviously Man City look fantastic, but Chelsea are barely even in third gear, and they're only 2 points off the top.
I think that's right. I think Mourinho might have also found his preferred combination, certainly in those three supporting attacking players, and Oscar, Hazard and Willian nowadays. They're playing brilliant one-touch football sometimes.
Well, big game for them. They're away at Hull, who scored six against a London side in their last appearance at the KC Stadium.
Yeah. Different London side.
Different London side, of course. That was their only win in the last seven, indeed. Although, if you go back a little bit further, when Liverpool came to the KC, they lost, 3-1? So, they got teeth, these Tigers.
Yeah, they're a very, very good team at home. And with that back three, that takes a lot of teams some time to adjust to playing against. So they've got that edge to them. It could be a tricky one. Chelsea not that great on the road.
Indeed. They won't have Ivanovic. They won't have Lampard either. And Tom Huddleston won't have much of his hair, so I don't know how that...
Did Tom Huddleston have his hair cut? I didn't hear anything about this.
It was a kind of... some people compared it to... Who was that cartoon character with the enormous bouffant and very short and so Johnny Bravo. It was obviously it was quite a lengthy job, because it was 2.5 years or something. It was over 2 years, I think, that he hadn't had it cut for. Do you want a quick shout on that? Are Chelsea going to win? What do you think, John?
It's a tough one. I think Hull have got the joint tightest defensive record or home record in the Premier League. Yeah, same amount of goals conceded as Arsenal and City and Liverpool. Chelsea do feel like they're just clicking into gear. Like City, actually. Both those teams feel like things are just coming up to the boil quite nicely.
Well, yeah, City, because the big question with them was, can they do it on the road? And can they? Because we thought they could, but then they went to Ewood Park and only drew 1-1. Or was that just because it was in the Cup?
Yeah, I mean, you have to take that into account, don't you? Yeah. Who are they playing? Who are City playing this weekend?
Who are City playing this weekend? They are at Newcastle, so it is a game on the road. Now, Newcastle, that was a tough place to go, etc., but now people are going there and winning. Arsenal did it, Cardiff in the FA Cup. Indeed, they've lost their last two in the league, 1-0, the Magpies.
But they've generally been on a very good run of form, and look, particularly when the first 11 is out, look a very strong unit
Newcastle.
All across the pitch. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, this has finished 4-0 to City on the last two occasions they've met. They looked utterly dominant in the opening game of the season at the Etihad. Yaya Toure went down clutching his knee for an extended period in the game against West Ham, but is he back up again and clanking forward?
Apparently so. Mm. I mean, that seemed enough to put most mortals out of contention for at least 4 to 6 weeks, but Yaya Toure was just carried off, squirted with WD-40 and returned to clank again, with extreme prejudice in this case.
Right.
The man's absolutely unstoppable. Torrid time last season. He just didn't really seem to be up for it in about two-thirds of all the games he played. But this season, there's just no stopping him.
Right, OK. City's away form. They haven't lost on the road since their 1-0 with Sunderland back in November. But apart from that Bayern game in the Champions League, they've only been at Fulham, Swansea, Leicester and Southampton. So,
Yeah, this is a big test. I think it's a big match. It's like, you know, when Arsenal won that game, I think that was a real marker for them, particularly
right.
psychologically, to show that they can do that. And I think same applies to City.
All right, well, just one point above them then coming into the weekend are Arsenal, who are at Aston Villa. Aston Villa, any history on this one?
Any history? You're going to tell me something that's entirely obvious that I can't remember.
The opening game of the season?
Oh, yeah.
there was that
thing.
Yeah, that thing, which, of course, sparked the arrival. So the story went, Arsenal was so shocked he went out and bought Mesut Ozil. Not sure yet if he's going to buy anyone this January, but, of course, now poor old Theo Walcott's out 6 months or so.
Yeah.
He's done his cruciate ligament
again.
Yeah,
hexed by Spurs fans.
Yeah. No World Cup, perhaps.
Terrible timing for him. I've never really been a huge Walcott fan. I'm sort of in the Chris Waddle school of not really being enthralled to his decision-making powers. But since he'd come back from his last injury, he had finally been looking like a complete modern inside forward.
Mm.
He was far more intelligent, far more canny on his use of the ball. It was just getting to the point where I was thinking some kind of mea culpa from myself might be in order, because I've been so mean to him in the past. So to get an injury now, it wasn't even just that 5 goals in 5 games, it was every aspect of his performance was immeasurably improved, and that's going to be a huge loss for Arsenal.
Right, they've got Giroud coming back, I think, this weekend, but to what extent is Walcott an irreplaceable figure for them? Oxlade-Chamberlain's a similar-ish
sort
player.
Of Serge Gnabry might be a better replacement, who's been showing signs of really exceptional talent. However, he's very, very young. He's still only 18, and you get this thing with young players where people don't always realise how good they are. Then they do. Then they start kicking them really, really hard just to see what happens. Or it turns out they've only really got one or two tricks. Both Andros Townsend and Raheem Sterling have had great opening games and then tailed off a bit as people have begun to figure them out. So it remains to be seen if Serge Gnabry will be able to get through that and sustain this kind of form. But, you know, it could be the making of him. It could be his big break.
All right. Well, they are at Aston Villa, who are absolutely rubbish at home. So
win for Villa, surely. Yeah, no, hopefully.
All right. Hopefully now, not. Mention those three sides below the leading three, Liverpool, Everton and Spurs. What awaits them this weekend? Well, Liverpool are at Stoke. Hey, last time when they went to the Britannia, they lost 3-1.
Yeah, and Stoke tend to be fairly solid and hard to beat at home.
Tough game, John.
It is a tough game, but there are no easy games at this level.
That's very true.
Unless you're playing them.
Peter Crouch up against his former side, and this could be, I read, his last game for the Potters, because he might make a move down to Crystal Palace.
Well, Pulis has sort of has got a couple of ex-Stokies there, hasn't he?
He has, actually, yeah. That's very true.
But it also probably be the case that Stoke's most effective player at the minute can't play.
Exactly. Mm. Exactly. That's Asaidi.
Asaidi, yeah. Asaidi. He's been scoring goals and very effective on the left.
3 goals in 5 games.
But again, it's another important marker for a team like Liverpool. You know, they have actually the most impressive thing outside of Suarez this season has been their consistency, their ability to bounce back from bad results like Hull. But you need to keep it going.
You do, don't you? What about your chums Norwich, who are hosting Everton?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think this whole kind of 11-team relegation battle has us very much in the middle of it. I think Barkley is a doubt, which would be good for us. But we're a bit like West Ham in a way, in that, you know, defensive solidity was our thing, and we don't really have that as much this season. We certainly we're prone to more errors. And we don't seem to be as cohesive. So, yeah, there's a lot of worry around the club at the minute. And there's been this little story about, will Villa sign Wes Houlihan?
Ooh, would they?
I don't think so, because our board absolutely hate Paul Lambert. So I think they would do it over their dead body. But there's turmoil and there's a lot of uncertainty at the club at right now. So, yeah,
right.
Worrying times.
Norwich in 15th place, haven't won in five, just 3 points above the team in 18th place, which is Crystal Palace. And tell us about the Murphy twins, though, Paul. Bring a smile to our faces.
Well, the Murphy twins are identical twins, and boy, are they identical. They're very difficult to tell apart, and not just for the fans, but for the coach as well, who had instructed. He said that he could tell them apart when they were up close, but when they were on the other side of the pitch, he had difficulty doing so. So he's asked that they wear different coloured boots.
Right. Josh and Jacob Murphy, who featured in the FA Cup game against Fulham.
Yeah, Josh is probably the leading one of the pair.
Right.
He's had a few substitute appearances, and that was his first start for the senior side. And he was effectively man of the match. He set up our equalising goal. He's got great tricks, good pace. You know, quite spindly at the moment, but you know, another one of these. You know, there seems to be a lot of young, wide English talent at the moment, and I'd probably put him in that bracket.
Right? Does his brother play a similar role?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Interesting.
You've also got one of the Olsons, haven't you?
Yes.
Another identical twin. No, just the one.
We've just got the one.
You need the other one for a full set.
Producer Ben says, Mary Kate or Ashley? Anyway, that's all very exciting. Norwich are going to be at Everton.
I'd say, yeah, Elizabeth.
Right.
She's a great actress.
Elizabeth Olsen.
Yeah, Elizabeth Actor. Sorry. Elizabeth Olsen is a great actor. And of the three, I would choose her.
Which is the one who's in that film about the cult?
Her.
Mm. And what's that film called?
Martha Macy May Marlene.
Good knowledge. And it is a great film. Mm.
It's good. Yeah, that final shot of that. It's another one. That final shot of that film is... I don't know if it counts in your story arc thing.
No, I just have obviously fundamentally misread this
another
bloody
one.
Book.
I've got another one. Invasion of the Body Snatchers. It's all about that final scene.
The point of the centre point and the point of the midpoint is that it's when the central character learns something that they can't unlearn. And therefore it takes them, it's the key for them kind of achieving the resolution at the end, but it means there's no turning back.
And fittingly, we're almost exactly in the midpoint of this particular pod story, and that's going to be the revelation, I think, for most listeners that they'll take away to the graves. That just leaves from those kind of three teams just behind the top three, Spurs, who are hosting Crystal Palace now. This is a big game, John. Hey, you're frowning at me like it's not, but I'm saying it is. It is. Spurs, they've got Tim Sherwood. He's still unbeaten in the league, but I just fancy Crystal Palace, Tony Pulis, to go there and do something to Spurs.
Why do you fancy them to do it?
I don't know. There's just something. I think Tony Pulis, he knows all about how to deal with a 4-4-2. And I think he just got enough to go there and sit back and defend and just basically stymie Sherwood Spurs.
Is it the old school Pulis against the new old school Sherwood?
Yeah. I was at Selhurst for the Norwich game, the most diabolical conditions I've ever watched football in, and Palace were poor. They were really poor. I mean, the wind didn't help, but technically. Spurs are going to have an awful lot of possession, and Crystal Palace are going to have to defend very well against two strikers.
Mm. Well, we've seen them hold Everton goalless before now. And they didn't do a bad job against Arsenal, though that was at Selhurst Park. Just curious.
I'm kind of with you on that one. I was at Tim Sherwood's press conference.
Can you provide some kind of rationale? Because I'm really struggling with that.
After the Arsenal press conference... I watched Tim Sherwood and I walked out of the room thinking he's not even going to make the end of the season. If he was absolutely serious that he hadn't surrendered possession in the middle and that defeat was nothing to do with his tactics, then I can't see him even finishing the season, because it was obvious to everyone watching that game exactly where it had gone wrong. They'd been double manned in the middle, they'd been double manned on one of the flanks where poor Danny Rose was up against Walcott and Sagner. It was there staring him in the face, but he was adamant it was nothing to do with it.
Is this the kind of fixture as well that Sherwood will go, a chance to play no defensive midfielders and go six up front and really bring some spectacle?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want this to be read as, you know, Tim Sherwood's a tactical simpleton. He's obviously not. He's got great experience in football at all levels as well, and working with very talented youngsters in the Tottenham development squad. He wants to make a clear difference between himself and his predecessor. He wants the football to be simple, fun, expressive, get it down, get it done, that kind of thing, without sitting there with a clipboard on his haunches, marshalling fullbacks forward and backward 6 inches. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But there are issues here, and I think managers like Tony Pulis, to go back to the original question some time ago, are going to have been watching Tim Sherwood's videotapes and thinking, right, there's how we do them. And yeah, I will place the price of a pint on Crystal Palace beating Tottenham.
Crikey.
Wow.
That's what's happening with those teams there. I should mention as well a couple of games for sides at the bottom. One is Saints, who are hosting West Brom, who don't have a manager, but Ian, they stabilised themselves a little bit.
They have a bit. They've actually picked up 6 points in the last four games.
How have they done that? That's not a lot, though, is it? Six out of the 12?
It's enough to keep you up.
I suppose it
just
is.
Just about. It's enough to stabilise a free fall, because before that, they only had 2 points in their last six games. So they might be getting to the point of just thinking, well, you know, we can leave this to ride for a bit. Though Thomas Schaff is apparently in quite advanced talks.
No, I heard that he wasn't.
Is he not now?
I don't know. It depends who you talk to. Thomas Schaff, who's at
Werder Bremen.
Werder Bremen.
For about 14 years.
Right, okay. And a huge game, Fulham-Sunderland. Sunderland once again coming off a victory in the League Cup. And taking it, but an hour away to Fulham. I don't know what to make of Fulham. I don't, John.
Well, they're the form team at the bottom at the moment. Well, they've won two of the last four, I think I'm right saying. Which
I got absolutely destroyed in one of the others.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, you pick up the odd result here and there, and that kind of, considering the form of the teams around them, like West Ham, like Sunderland, like Cardiff, you know, a couple of wins makes you stand apart from that lot. Yeah, I fancy them to turn Sunderland over, to be honest.
They won 1-0 up at the Stadium of Light, and they have done well at picking up points from the teams around them.
Yeah, and Mühlenstein seems to have... I mean, it's clearly a work in progress for him.
Right. It's very much Mühlenstein, I'm told.
Oh, is it really?
Mühlenstein. Yeah, Mühlenstein.
But he's being able to make effective use of some of the more senior players like Darren Bent, John Alarisa back in the side.
Right.
And that you think will kind of lend them a little bit more steadiness, stability and predictability maybe.
Right, although that doesn't begin with stir, but we'll allow you that one.
Thank you.
We'll have a quick pause now and then we're back in with part three. Right, now here's a headline for you, torn from the front page of today's Bild. Respect. Ja, ich liebe Männer. How about that? That's Thomas Hitzelsberger there. And that's, the German Bild saying respect. And interesting, massive story this has been. Too massive, perhaps, some would say.
No, I think it's just been about the right level. I think there's been the right amount of people coming out and saying, let's hope that one day this isn't an issue. And this doesn't have to be a story, but it's going to be this steady sort of trickle as one by one the progress is made. But with every Hitzelsberger, with every Robbie Rogers, you know that there's some kid somewhere who's been wrestling with this for a while and will actually have the confidence and the strength to make their own decision, make their own life choices and not have to feel like they're hiding away all the time. So it can only be seen
Robbie Rogers there, actually, because he's somebody who's still a footballer, which is, I think, quite unique, is it not? In terms of coming out?
To be out and still a footballer. Yeah, very much so. I can't think of any others, apart from Glenn Heisen's son.
Mm. Oh, yeah, good chat. Yeah. Sorry, Paul, you were about to say?
Well, no, and it just brings into focus the ridiculous nature of the fact there are, you know, in all the major leagues in Europe, there is not one openly out player.
Yeah, it's interesting, actually. One point that Hitzelsberger makes is that, to be honest, it's not like he felt he was really concealing it all these years. Eventually, I think in his interview with Rafa, pretty much his teammates would just gave up asking him why he didn't have a girlfriend, and it was an accepted thing. So maybe people overestimate, or maybe they don't. I don't know. I'm not in these kind of alpha male fulcrum of intensities that are football dressing rooms.
Yeah, it's quite interesting listening to Graham Lasseau got interviewed on the radio, and he was saying he received recently, within the last month, an emailed apology from Robbie Fowler.
Did he?
For his abuse back in the 90s.
Right.
That famous, when he was into making uncouth goal celebrations, etc., etc.
Mm. Presenting himself, wasn't he?
Yeah. He presented himself. Anyway, super stuff for Thomas Hitzelsberger, and well done to everyone for reacting in the right way. Let's next talk about Qatar. Hey, well, they're going to have a World Cup in winter. Huzzah!
Yeah, to no one's great surprise.
To no one's great surprise. I'm not entirely sure what my feelings are on this. I mean, to explain, in a way, I'm thinking, well, am I just being a bit stuck in the mud, going, no, it's going to be in the summer? Yeah, is it actually really that much of a problem if just once they have it in the winter and then around Christmas we have all the delights of a World Cup to, you know, brighten those long winter evenings and that? And beyond that, and there is a debate perhaps to be had on that, and it'll probably be won by the side that says, no, it should be played in the summer because it's going to completely disrupt the rest of football. Beyond that, it's just the way, and I'm not saying anything new here, the way that FIFA have done it is such a massive lack of any interest in having any dignity or coherence or anything. It's just, it's astonishing. It's astonishing.
Well, it would be if it was anybody else apart from FIFA.
But have they not? Is this not their
yeah, I think it's a new...
their masterpiece.
A new low for them, isn't it? And I think the people who can be particularly irritated by it are the other bids, like Australia, who have got every right to kind of feel right. Quite aggrieved that the premise that Qatar were awarded the tournament on has now completely
and the
changed.
US and the TV companies, yeah, who pay billions for the rights to show the World Cup and now have it in the entirely the wrong time of year. I mean, the point's been made about people in the States where they're quite busy with the NFL and all those other things through the winter. And
it's not really that easy to feel sympathy for TV companies with regard to football, though, is it?
I think what it is, everyone's just casting around for... we're clearly powerless to halt in any way or even slow FIFA, who frankly don't give a two figs about anything, apart from perhaps money. So anybody who can come in and mount a serious legal action against them might be the only hope.
Perhaps it's will be a point of awakening for everybody that realise that FIFA don't have any limits on what they do and don't have anybody controlling them, and maybe there will be change.
But brilliantly, the people they seem to have most offended this time are their own committee members, who are all coming out going, hang on, I thought we were talking about this next month. You know, they apparently didn't even think that this had been decided yet. So someone's making the decisions without even telling the senior committee.
Good Lord.
Which is quite terrifying. But I think, you're right, there's a lot of, I think, guilt from those of us in more established football nations like England or like the rest of Europe, who are starting to think, well, are we just saying this because, we're used to it being all done for our convenience and at our time and to make sure that our leagues aren't interrupted? Because obviously elsewhere around the world, other leagues are disrupted by the World Cup. It's just a thing that no one ever mentions. But there are no reasons for giving the World Cup to Qatar. The only reason that anyone ever comes up with is they've never had it before, or the region has never had it before. But only a handful of nations have ever had the World Cup
before. I think
there
were a lot of reasons for giving the World Cup to Qatar.
If you look at Australia, then you've got an area, a region of the world that has never had a World Cup before, so that's a tick. It's a nation that's never had it before, there's another tick. They have the stadiums there already, they have a population, they have a vibrant domestic league, which is on the up, they have the potential for it to be even bigger, and they have the climate where the whole thing could have been done without anyone really getting too upset about stuff. And you look at Qatar, tell me something that Qatar's got, apart from the thing we're not going to mention.
Silence around the room.
Yeah. Mm.
I wonder what the knock-on effect of it might be, that once you've done... Particularly, I'm wondering about a winter break in the English league. Once you've actually interrupted...
Well, this is a two-month winter break.
Yeah, but once you've established that, once you've...
What do you think? Do you think the leagues, in the same way that they don't actually stop domestic competition for the Africa Cup of Nations, do they go, well, you know what, it's only 25 players for this country, 25 players for that country. Do we just say, get on with it, and everybody cut your transfer cloth accordingly? Because it's 2 months out of the season.
That would be a massive...
And the Champions League as well.
Yeah, because you wonder about the continuing viability. The World Cup is so popular with people that it's managed to kind of outride this fact that everything is increasingly focused on clubs and away from the national teams. But that could be something that broke there.
Or do you say national teams, you can take the under-21s?
At what point do the clubs get together and go, if we all pull out at once, as one, then we can have our own World Cup because we own the players.
Yeah.
FIFA don't own anything.
Mm. That's a really good point you make, James.
Well, I liked Ian's point.
Well, you've raised the counterfactual possibilities, and then Ian's getting in there exploring it.
But clubs don't have the... Legally, they can't withdraw players or withhold players from national teams and still remain in a FIFA-recognised competition. That's the issue that they continually come up against.
So screw FIFA.
But then they can't, because the Premier League, for example, or Serie A or Bundesliga, they're all FIFA recognised. So unless the leagues themselves collectively decide the way fingers at the thing. Well, that's the next interesting thing that happens there, I guess. But
The leagues we know are enthralled to the clubs anyway. Scudamore often says his purpose is to find the best solution for the clubs.
Yeah.
Otherwise, they'll remove him and find someone else who can. So there's the line of power And that's where this could go. I don't think it will, because it rarely does. There's always some kind of compromise done in a back room somewhere.
Well, that's what, but I think
that's what I'd be
assumed.
Worrying about if I was FIFA.
Interesting.
Well, I mean, what they presumably will do is not let it run over Christmas, because then clubs start missing out on the big gates from Boxing Day and New Year's games.
Only in England. For the rest of Europe, that's exactly the time you'd want to have it, because that's when they're on a break anyway. I mean, Germany are off until, when is it, January 23rd or something? They have a month off around this time of year. It's not as big an issue for them. But you can't have it in January, February, because that's when the Winter Olympics will be. So it's going to be November, December is the likely suggestion.
But one reaction to all of this is, if you do insert a winter break, then the season has to be extended at either end, which crosses into the summer, which crosses into the time when the big clubs are taking their teams out to Asia, or out to the Middle East, or out to America for very, very lucrative pre- and post-season tours.
Right.
You can't do that if the season's extended.
Well, so far we haven't heard, previously we have, but after this latest announce, we haven't heard the usual threatening noises from either the players or the clubs, or indeed the major European leagues. Let's dial up Sid Lowe and just hear maybe a little bit what the reaction is in Spain, where there's one or two other big stories to talk about as well. On second thoughts, let's instead talk about the Championship, John Ashdown, where there's been big news.
Well, fairly big news in South London, certainly, where...
It's big news, John.
Well, it's quite big news for Millwall, especially, and Ian Holloway is back in the game, which is...
Cool. How much of a surprise is that?
That is a bit of a turn-up, yeah, absolutely. You know, it's only kind of, what is it, 6-7 miles across London from Palace to Millwall, if that, so it's kind of a fairly local trip for him. They're struggling down at the bottom end of the Championship, having really flailed under Steve Lomas's leadership. But they've got a few talented players there. You know, you look at the squad, and it's not a bad one. And Ian Holloway's record in the Championship is fantastic.
Yeah, it is. It's just that the way he left Crystal Palace, basically going, I've got no idea how to sort this out. It's early in the season. They weren't completely out of the picture, as we've seen under Tony Pulis. And he just kind of almost seemed to hold his hands up and say, do you know what? I just haven't got it in me to try and turn this around.
But it's interesting how many managers seem to leave clubs going, oh, I'm completely drained, completely tired. I've lost the imagination, I've lost, you know, I don't know what I'm doing anymore. And then it's only a couple of months later that they turn. But it happens surprisingly often. And I think Holloway being that kind of slightly, he's always been a bit of a different character, and Millwall's always been a slightly different kind of club. So
maybe not necessarily in the same way.
Not in the same way, exactly. But, you know, it feels like a good fit.
Is it not sort of an inverse Sam Allardyce, though, where Allardyce is appointed to West Ham, a club with renown for flair and glorious play, and he brings in a pragmatic approach. And the pragmatism of Millwall, the up and at 'em, is been their consistent quality.
Right. Meantime, Paul Ince is on the brink, it says here, at Blackpool, where Michael Chopra has been fined for his rude tweetings about training. What's he said?
He said he, with a few F's in there, he said he turned up for training and there was only six players there and it was being run by the fitness coach on Twitter. And he's going to be fined. Blackpool have turned into a sort of slightly foul-mouthed club this year. Because
Ince course.
Was done for his... effing C at the fourth official against Bournemouth, was it, and got a 5-game stadium ban. And even before that, he was moaning. Since then, he's moaned about the crap trips to Yeovil on a crap Tuesday night and da 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 da. Yeah, they started off the season incredibly well, winning 5 of the first 6. Since then, they've been really poor. I think they've only won 3 times since. And Ince is one of those managers who gets jobs without. You know, without having the record to back it up, it strikes me as...
Did well at Macclesfield.
Did well at MK Dons, but he's not really shone anywhere since and was bombed out of Notts County, was it, last season, after 6 months in charge, having, you know, come up with some various historically record-breaking terribleness there. But, yeah, on the brink, and they need a change because it's getting a bit stale there.
Oh, dear. All right. Paul Raymond says, now that we're halfway in, which will be the first and last major European league to crown a champion? Not sure what the last will be. Could well be Spain. Could well be the Premier League, indeed. First, at this point, looks like being Serie A, where Juve are romping away with it. 8 points clear. Quite excited about this weekend when Keisuke Honda will be making his debut for the Rossoneri. They had a big win on Monday against Atalanta 3-0, with the Kaká getting 2 goals. He's very much back. And their young Canadian fellow, Brian Cristante, played terrifically. And anyway, they're going to be away at probably I'm going to say the smallest club in any of the top European top divisions, Sassuolo, whose official kind of inhabitant count is about 40,000 people. So it's smaller than a lot of stadiums, you know. You could get them all at not their stadium because it's a tiny place, but you could get them in. Anyway, that's coincidentally a game I'm going to be covering live for Sunday night.
I was going to say, aren't Hoffenheim famous for having a stadium that's actually bigger than their population
Right. And Villarreal as well, is that not?
Yeah, that might be Villarreal. They're all about that size. I think Sassuolo might just nick it, but I'm not sure. Giuseppe Rossi's off in Colorado waiting to hear about how bad his knee is. Best of luck to him. And Di Natale, Antonio Di Natale, the great Toto Di Natale, who's given us so many great YouTube goals over the years and stayed loyal to Udinese. They lost to Verona. Hey, with Luca Toni scoring a brace and looking generally good. Remember Luca Toni? Remember
Blimey,
him?
Yes. Yeah. Real blast from the past.
Yeah, absolutely. He's still knocking them in. And anyway, he was so upset by that defeat at home to Verona, Udinese's Toto saying that he's going to retire at the end of this season, that everyone's hoping that he was just a bit miffed and might reconsider. Alessio Di Maria, no relation, I'm presuming, asking, what are the chances of Luciano Spalletti, meanwhile, taking over at Milan? Because Allegri said he's going to resign or go on his way at the end of the season. As far as I can tell from Spalletti's own quotes, he's going to see out his contract, which is another season after this one, at Zenit St. Petersburg. The talk in Italy seems to be very much Clarence Seedorf still, or Andre Villas-Boas for the Rossoneri, which would be very interesting given his, well, predilection for his the way he likes to set up, and Berlusconi's insistence that the DNA of the club is all about playing with two up front. We shall see. Anyway, let's dial up the Sid again.
Hello.
Hey! Bingo! Sid, we got you this time. Last time you were off feeding your parking meter when we tried before, perhaps.
Ah, right. Oh. Now that's an ambulance going past. You phoned a minute ago, didn't you? I was on the metro, I'm afraid. Sorry about that.
All right, no worries. Crikey, you're out on the street, Sid.
I am treading the beat, yeah.
Wow, cool. Now, Sid, so many exciting things to discuss.
Really, really big news the last two or three days in Spain. There's been quite a lot going on.
Absolutely. Now, I want to ask you, first of all, about a story that wasn't in Spain at all, but the FIFA's confirmation, apparently, that the World Cup's going to be in the winter. Has there been much Spanish reaction? Has there been any kind of rumblings about action and things?
No, I mean, I think more than anything else, so far it's been taken as a confirmation of something that they assumed was going to happen. It hasn't yet, I think, kind of been worked through in terms of people looking at it and looking at how that will affect the season and what it means for domestic competition. That's just starting now. I mean, there's been a few minor comments from Javier Tebas, who's the president of the league, about what the best way of handling this is. And it's interesting that, I think anyway, it's interesting that it's been looked at in terms of how we deal with this situation rather than any attempt at saying, well, actually, we've got to fight this. And I don't think there's going to be any real backlash. I asked the Minister of Sport about this when I spoke to him back in, when was it, September, I think. And at the time, he was kind of basically wriggling out of it. And he said, well, we don't know if it'll be moved from the summer to the winter. And if and when it happens, then we'll formulate a plan and then we'll talk about what we do. So I expect at some stage that he will have something to say about it.
Right, okay. Now, in other news, Xavi Alonso has extended his contract by 2 years. What's the situation with Morata, Arsenal target Morata of Real Madrid?
Well, I mean, managers lie. We talked about this a little bit the other day, didn't we? Managers lie, but Carlo Ancelotti has said that he doesn't think anyone's going to leave and he doesn't think anyone's going to come in. There's going to be no movement at all at Real Madrid. Morata is someone that, unless there was an obvious replacement, Real Madrid will be very reluctant to let him go. But it is true that Morata wants more minutes. It is true that Morata has told Real Madrid that, and that he's also he's aware of Arsenal's interest. And I think it's not something that he would be reluctant to do. I think he'd be relatively keen. But, of course, I think he'd be keen in terms of a loan deal with the possibility of then coming back to Real Madrid. But Madrid, I don't think Madrid are going to let this happen because, for the simple reason, they don't have a huge amount of strikers. Now, the advantage from Morata's point of view, which, of course, is also the disadvantage wrapped into one, is the fact that in the kind of ranking of strikers, it was very definitely Benzema, Morata, then Jesse, with some people even demanding Morata ahead of Benzema. there's no doubt now that Morata is the third of those players, that Jesse has gone beyond him, and I think he will get relatively limited minutes between now and the end of the season. But it's still only three strikers, and Madrid aren't keen at all to let him go, and I suspect that means that it won't happen.
All right. Angel Di Maria, after he grabbed his own crotch while being taken off by Carlo Ancelotti?
Yeah, there's a bit of me that thinks that despite Madrid saying no one will go, if there was a really good bid for Angel Di Maria, then I think they would accept it. Bear in mind that in the summer, with the signing of Gareth Bale, Real Madrid were looking at ways of recovering some of the money, and there were two basic options. One was Mesut Ozil, one was Angel Di Maria. At the time, Di Maria was told that he would get opportunities. He I think believes that Real Madrid have reneged a little bit on that. I think he believes that some of his absences from the team haven't been based purely on footballing meritocracy, and I think that's one of the reasons why he's so frustrated now. But at the time, it was Mesut Ozil who went, not Angel Di Maria. Angel Di Maria himself said back then that it was partly because Cristiano Ronaldo had spoken up for him. My feeling would be that this won't happen, but if there was a really good bid, then I think Real Madrid would look at it. Angel Di Maria himself keeps saying that I want to stay.
Right, okay. In other news, see, Copa del Rey, Messi is back and he scored two goals on his return.
Yeah, it was ridiculous, really, wasn't it? Messi was actually standing on the touchline and had been waiting to come on for a couple of minutes when Barcelona got a penalty. And I'm sure that a good 90% of the people in the stadium were thinking, this is incredible. They're going to bring him on to take the penalty. He's going to score with his first touch after 2 months. They didn't do it. That would have felt a bit forced. But then kind of what came next felt a little bit forced, almost too good as well. Tata Martino afterwards described it as being like a cinema script, and Messi came on slightly slowly to start with, eased his way into the game, scored one which was a simple goal, and then scored a second which was very much the classic Messi goal, accelerating through, ball really close to his foot. Really, really nice finish, left-footed quite high into the top of the net. And he looked very, very sharp indeed. And, of course, this has been managed really carefully. And I think it's been managed not only with Messi's physical state in mind, but also with the fixture list in mind, because this now means the half an hour that he got yesterday and the performance and the fact that he came through with no injuries and looking sharp and playing very well, of course, means he's ready for Atletico Madrid at the weekend, which is going to be huge.
Wow, that is a huge game. Those two teams are still only goal difference apart on top of the Liga.
That's right, yeah. 18 games, 16 wins, one draw and one defeat, each of them. They're both 5 points clear of Real Madrid. So, of course, I suppose, in a way, the big winners this weekend are Real Madrid, because their problem until now has been that Atletico and Barcelona just haven't dropped points. Or this weekend, by definition, at least one of them has to.
Mm. All right. See, one final thing. In other less positive Copa del Rey news, the extraordinary scenes at Racing Santander, where the fans tried to attack their own president.
Yeah, I'm glad you picked up on this, because I think, to some extent, I think there's been a little bit of a failure in the Spanish media in terms of the way that this has been, not by everyone, in the terms of the way this has been covered, because it's been looked at as, look at those fans trying to attack their president, isn't it terrible? Now, of course, a fan trying to attack a president is terrible, but the context of this is the extraordinary destruction of Racing Santander by a series of charlatans, owners and thieves over the last few years. That this explodes in this way, you know, no one's trying to justify the violence, but that this explodes in this way, I think, was probably likely to happen at some stage. I don't know if you've seen the other footage from the game, but from the kickoff, 20 seconds of Racing Santander's players not moving as part of protest. They haven't been paid, the players. Fans have been moved from the position in which they sit in the stands to basically take them away from the director's box. And this is the club that got basically ruined by Ali Syed, who, of course, was the man who failed a fit and proper persons test in England but was allowed to take over Racing Santander with the help of the president, a guy called Francisco Pernilla, who continued to be part of the Spanish Federation, and with the help of a guy called Revilla, who's a local politician who is, it's probably best I don't say what I think he is.
Mm. Right, so just describe what happened then. About 20 fans tried to storm the director's box.
It's very difficult to judge the numbers, because this is the other thing, of course, that this has been seen as this incredible assault on the director's box, people trying to get in. But of course, the vast majority of people had come from the end and were standing in front of the director's box and chanting protests. Some seem to be trying to get in, but the footage is not entirely clear, but the footage is very, you know, and it's powerful. I mean, it really is, and it's pretty unpleasant. And there was an interesting interview last night with the president of Almeria. Now, the president of Almeria, who I thought personally was wrong in the way that he analysed it, because, of course, he analysed it from the perspective of someone who knows nothing about what's happened at Racing Santander. But at the same time, his kind of his witness report of it was fascinating, because it was from someone in the director's box genuinely scared. You know, what on earth is going on? People are trying to get in here, and things are being thrown. But I think the overall impact, it might look slightly worse than it is, but of course it is terrible, and it's a really bad situation, in the sense that beyond just what happened last night, there's a very, very good chance of Racing Santander going out of business.
That brings to an end today's Very Much Football Weekly Extra. Paul, you've already moved on to reading the papers, I see. What have you found?
I was just reading about the next episode of Benefit Street.
What's Benefit Street?
Benefit Street is this Channel 4 documentary, which is about a street where everyone's on benefits, apparently. Ah. And it just paints people in a very, very bad light and makes you disgusted to be human.
When did Channel 4 become the channel that gets us to laugh and point at poor people?
Probably about 7 or 8 years ago. Oh. It started with, you know, physical freaks, and then it moved into gypsies.
Oh, yeah.
Now it's everybody.
Here's some gypsies. Laugh at gypsies. Laugh at them.
Mm. Yeah. Nice dresses.
Thanks for that, Paul. Tell you what, is that just not the classic example of the best bit coming at the end again? Or would you say that your most memorable bit of the show was another? In which case, which one was it?
Well, it was probably when I was stuttering over trying to get out some vaguely half-remembered Bob Monkhouse joke.
Bob Monkhouse,
which
right.
Which came.
I think producer Ben cut that, though, so nobody knows what you. Yeah, when?
I think what I'm going to do is, yeah, I'm going to go back. I'm going to actually read the book properly, and then I'm going to write it. It's a great book, and there's a long extract on the Guardian website, actually. Ooh. So you don't even have to get the book; you can read it and get all the key details.
That's on the culture bit, is it?
It is. It's on. It was serialized last year. So look for John York, Into the Woods, Guardian, and then we can all become great screenwriters like William.
Brilliant,
Goldman.
John. Is there anything you'd like to tout from the Guardian website or elsewhere?
No. Although one thing I was going to mention today, which I didn't get a chance to, didn't really come up.
Right.
Was that I had a weird dream last night.
Great.
About Greg Bukowski,
really,
fellow Podder, in which he was in a boy band, but it was a rock boy band.
Yeah.
So he was like the front man,
like Busted.
Yeah. Yeah, essentially. Or what's that other one?
McFly.
Yeah.
McBusted. The two of them together.
Yeah.
As they are now.
Yeah, did you not know?
No, I didn't know that.
Very much so.
Anyway, it's just one of those snapshots that is going to stick in my head all day,
right,
of him sliding towards the camera, which is kind of my point of view of the dream, in a green and silver spangly jumpsuit, essentially, doing a full-on knee slide towards the camera. Greg Bukowski, ladies and gentlemen.
Follow that, Ian McIntosh.
I don't think I should.
Interpret that.
It's an enduring image. That will be the point of the show that the viewers take away.
Yeah, I think it probably will.
Or listeners, even.
Listeners, even. But in that sense, it was so visual. Viewers, I think you're right, yeah. Great stuff. That's it, then. We'll be back on Monday, so do join us for that as we round up, etc. and so on. And have a lovely weekend.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag-and-drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today, no credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code GUARDIAN.